We are a religious people. We define ourselves by our seven principles. These principles represent a way of life. That way of life is characterized by dignity, justice, equity, compassion, acceptance. We value spiritual growth, freedom, an unencumbered search for truth and meaning, a non-intrusive political process, peace, liberty, justice, respect for all living things, respect for the relationship between all things, and fair play. We see these aspects in our history from our faith ancestors, the Socinians, who promoted democracy, separation of church and state, equality among persons. We hear these ideas and thoughts in the words of one of our founders in this country, William Ellery Channing, in his work called The Free Mind. I call that mind free, which is not passively framed by outward circumstances and is not the creature of accidental impulse. I call that mind free, which protects itself against intrusiveness, which refuses to be a slave, a tool of the many. I call that mind free, which sets no bounds to its love, which wherever to its love delights in the virtue of sympathy and has compassion for the suffering. Again, from Channing, from our reading today. The great end of religious instruction is not to stamp out, not to stamp our minds upon the young, but to stir up their own. And he ends with, to excite and cherish our spiritual life. We are a religious people, and we have religious sensibilities. And because of that, we have responsibilities to one another and to our community at large. The Christian fundamentalists have a saying, and I think we can gain wisdom from this saying, however we want to interpret it. And the saying is, there is a way for Satan to have a great victory, and that's to create a belief that there is no Satan. I think we can say from that wisdom, one of the greatest weapons the lords of tyranny can have is to make people in slavery think they're free. Today, the sermon is entitled, Run for the Hills, the Salvationists Are Coming. And there's a reason for that. Wherever there is Salvationist, there is usually an army. I can remember my involvement with some people in the Vero Beach Unitarian Universalist Church, and there was a couple there who had been all over the world, and he was an engineer, and he had done work in South America, third world countries, and we were discussing the flag, and there's a lot of attachment to the flag and patriotism and symbolizing who we are as a people. And he reminded us that not everybody in the world is appreciative when they see our flag coming. So he brought some honesty to the dialogue. And I think that's what we need to do also in the terms of the Salvationist religions, because we Unitarian Universalists are a Salvationist religion. Whether we like it or not, it is our heritage. And through time, you can see three different types of Salvationist religion. Those types are the exploitive type, the dissociative type, and the prophetic or the reforming type of Salvationist religion. You can also see three types of belief systems that structure our culture: the exploitive type, the dissociative type, and the reforming type. It's the same no matter what language you wrap it in, no matter what word you put it in. It's the same. Somehow, we human beings in our relationship to ourselves and others fall in these three general categories, exploitive, dissociative, and reforming. Certainly when you look at our universalist history, especially at the turn of the century, we see reforming and we see the great movements bringing about the houses of care for people who are suffering, for single mothers, for people who were victimized by an oppressive industrial system where they were in the ghetto, and it was the universalists that moved in and helped take care of these people. So we have three types: exploitive, dissociative, the prophetic, the reforming. What does the exploitive look like? The first thing I noticed when I started reading the definition of exploitation, the exploitive, was that it talked about a relationship to an object, a relationship to natural resources, a relationship to that which you had no mutuality with, something to be used. Something to be used for your benefit without necessarily concern for what's being used or where it's coming from. Exploitive. No mutuality. What then is the exploitive religion? Now we're on dangerous ground, because if we point our fingers at something that's an exploitive religion, we say there's no mutuality, and we say that the leaders, the priests, the prophets, the ministers, the people in the pulpit exploit the people that they speak to. Exploitive. Well, I'm going to suggest that ministers who have jets have exploited people. I'm going to suggest ministers that make over $1 million a year are involved in an exploitive process. Because throughout our history as a faith tradition and a history of Christianity and Judaism, the people that walked closest with their understanding of God, the people that walked closest with their highest values, were people who believed in simplicity, and people who believed in mutuality, and people who had empathy for those who suffered, and they did not have private jets. Mostly they were persecuted. Last month, we read the book Shock Doctrine. And in one of the principles in Shock Doctrine was how a group of people would sit and wait for another group of people to enter a crisis. And when these other group of people entered a crisis, the people that were sitting in wait would take advantage of these people and restructure their lives, restructure their legislative process, restructure their community. And he used Katrina, and he used Iraq, and they gave us different examples. For example, after the invasion of Iraq, and Paul Bremer, I guess was the viceroy, maybe that's the word, governor, he made a law that contractors, U.S. employees that were working in Iraq were not subject to the law of Iraq. And now we see the crisis that has occurred because of that with Blackwater, and that the people in Iraq who carry guns are not subject to the law of Iraq, and then there's no consequence of the particular behavior. The Shock Doctrine is about exploitation. Now, before we point the fingers at many more, how many of us have exploited people we love? I mean, how do we make this also personal? How many of us are exploiters? How many of us manipulate to get to go to the movie that I want to see and not necessarily my partner? Does it get to be that simple? How many of us exploit the hen by saying, you dig the hole and then get out of the hole so I can get in the hole and be deepest so I can become king? Did the rooster exploit the hen? Yes. Did the wren exploit the eagle riding up high? Yes. To become king. Exploitation necessarily has a relationship to power and dominance. We exploit for power and dominance. And when you have a religion, a salvationist religion, that's exploitive, you will see a class differentiation in the religion itself. You will see a royal priesthood. And in ancient, and in Judaism, and in the days before Christ was born, you see the prophets railing against the priesthood that was involved in an economic system that was oppressive to the poor. So we have the exploitive type. And mostly it is the exploitive types, the exploitive type of religion that has the standing army. The dissociative type. The dissociative type of religion. Now, I'm trying to understand, how does that get together? How does a religion facilitate, nurture, value a dissociative process? I mean, my guess is we know about dissociation from our understanding of the effect of trauma on individuals. That when an individual is traumatized, they dissociate to get through the trauma. When a child is traumatized, psychologically, often they can't process the trauma, so they dissociate, and while they're going through the trauma, often their mind is out here. They could be witnessing the trauma. They could be playing with their toys. While the trauma is going on, they're creating this whole other life out here. Often that is the seed of dissociative identity disorder, creating another personality. So when we understand dissociation, somehow we move off-center and we become dualistic inside. We become separated inside. We become split inside. We become other than who we our truest selves, other than who we truly are, and we live our life out in a dissociative state. I have often wondered if our nation didn't become dissociative as a nation after the assassination of John Kennedy. That we never really resolved the grief as a nation after the assassination, because we could not believe that that would happen in our country to a beloved leader. And then another dissociation, Martin Luther King, another dissociation, Robert Kennedy, whether we are for them or not, that that would happen within our nation. So we learn that whole nations can be dissociative. And I'm suggesting that the dissociative religion is absolutely necessary for the exploitive religion. Because we don't exploit if we're not dissociated. So those two have a relationship with one another. Do we live in a state of dissociation in this country? Has dissociation become the norm in our nation? How many of us have an ideal, how many of us have an idea of the way things ought to be, but we don't have any behavior moving in the direction of what ought to be? How many of us know better? And we still do the things we know better to do. Do we live in a dissociative state in where we live, how we live? I'm saying we cannot survive in this country without being in a dissociative state. There is so much stimulus that comes at us that it's hard for us to process it all. When you listen to the presidential debates, whether it's the Republican or whether it's the Democrat, how many ideas flow into the questions, and then we're trying to discern whether a person's dodging the question, whether they're really answering the question, whether they're answering the question just so they can get votes because we have an idea if they got in office, they're not going to do it anyway. And we're flooded, and we go, well, who can we trust, or is this a hopeless situation? And we don't have any confidence in the process at all. And some of the people that we think really speak for democracy, and some of the people that we really think speak for an unintrusive political process, get 1% of the votes or get no percent of the votes or don't even get on the radar screen. And we know it to be true and we scratch our heads and we wonder what in the world's going on. We live in a dissociated state. So the question is, if there's truth to that, how do we care for ourselves? How do we move out of it? How do we integrate? And I know as a counselor that integrating dissociative states is a very painful process, and a process, one of the healthiest statements you can hear in a counseling process is this: I don't want to do this. I don't want to reflect on my history and make meaning out of my history. I don't want to do it. That is one of the healthiest statements. I don't want to believe that there are people in South America that when they see my flag coming are more fearful than hopeful. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that people in the leadership positions don't actually have my welfare in their eye and for their concern. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that I'm of no concern to the other. I don't want to believe it. And when I do believe it, it's painful. And it renders me helpless because I feel overwhelmed. I can remember, for whether it was right or not, as a youngster in my early teens and late teens, during the Vietnam War, when somebody suggested to me that our government was paving roads in the jungle just to make money. Whether that's true or not, it was a shock to me that we wouldn't be in Vietnam for attempts at democracy and for good, just reasons, that we would be there for other than good, just reasons. It was one of the first shocks for me that I would consider that that was a possibility, that our leadership would do that. Do we live in a state of dissociation? Yes. Yes, we do. We are a religious people, and our religious faith, when we look through it, has always fought for integration and for wholeness over and against tyranny that would lead us to live in a dissociative state. The Unitarian Universalist religion has always done that. Our seven principles call us to integrate the fragmented parts of who we are as individuals. Our Unitarian Universalist principles cause us to integrate the fragmentation of our country, of our nation, of our community. Our principles call us to say to people, what are you talking about when you talk about health care? It is part of our calling to have that movie Sicko in here and to bring the doctor in here to talk to us about it. No matter what, where we fall on the spectrum, we are called to have the conversation. The prophetic tradition, the reforming tradition, is this. The prophet points to problem areas. It's not about prophecy about the future. The prophet points to problem areas and talks about probable consequences. Not a magic future that's going to happen. The prophet points to a healthcare system and says there's a problem. The religions, the salvationist religions, who are genuine reform salvationist religions, who are into the Reformation process, would see a problem of 50 million people without healthcare insurance and would say, we need to reform our society so that problem no longer exists. And our faith tradition falls in that category of the salvationist religion tradition that's of the Reformation, that is a reforming, social reforming faith tradition. It is who we are. You cannot look in our history and not find heroines and heroes who are not trying to reshape society so that all people's needs are met. No matter where you look in our history, there we are. Marginalized as it is, but nonetheless, there we are. In the front of reforming our society to bring about justice, to being able to implement compassion. We can be compassionate for people, but if there are not the structures, the legislative process, to help us implement behavior that comes after the compassion, what good is the compassion? What good is it? What good is my empathy if I have no way of enacting my empathy to move in the direction to take care of the things that caused the empathy in the first place? Our religion and our faith tradition is the vehicle that we use to answer our calling to reform our society. And that comes from the salvationist tradition. My question to myself is, how vulnerable am I to live in the exploitive track of salvationist history, to live in the dissociative track of salvationist history? Or am I aware that I'm vulnerable to be there, because there's a lot of energy that would put us to inactivity but to feel good about gathering, that I would have the courage to claim who I am in this historical tradition, to move to action, to begin the process of reformation, to begin the process of transformation, so that our principles can be enacted, so that we can take care of those who are less fortunate and also take care of ourselves at the same time. Our tradition, at the risk of being sinful, we can be proud and have pride in our faith tradition. Not arrogant, but have pride in who we are as a people and as a community. And we need to feel that pride, because that pride will give us strength to do the things that we need to do to honor who we are as Unitarian Universalists. So I must ask myself the question, of the three salvationist religion tracks, where do I live? Where do I live? Am I an exploiter? Do I live in a dissociative process? Or am I genuinely involved in reforming not just society, but myself as in society as well? When the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, Chapter 12, verse 2. He says that we are to restore and renew our minds and not be conformed to this world. That spiritual principle lets us know that we are vulnerable to be conformed to the world. Or why in the world would that spiritual teacher tell us we need to transform our mind and not be conformed? How do we own how we are conformed? Because we are. If I'm born in this culture, I'm conformed to this culture. But how do I become aware? How do I have vision? How do I see that which I'm blind to in order to change it? It doesn't happen automatically. How do I see it? How do I bring myself into conversation and into view, to hear feedback from others about who I am and how I am? How do I come to those terms myself? How do I face my own conformity and have the courage to begin a transformation process and then contribute that process to a community and then contribute that process to, say, this community and then to the community at large? How do I do that? How do you do that? When Channing says we cherish and excite the spiritual life, do we cherish and excite our spiritual lives? Do we? When we do, and when we're excited, we are not depressed. We are not dissociated. We are not exploiting. When we are excited about our faith and our faith tradition and the things that we're up to, we are involved in the process of transformation, not only ourselves and our community, but our society at large. When we sense the excitement and the joy and the desire to gather, we have to feel that, have that energize who we are as human beings, knowing we're vulnerable to lean in a way that's not congruent with our faith tradition. Knowing that, how do I begin to lean in the way that offers me a life-giving process, a life-giving community, a life-giving sense of self? Today we face the question, which religious tract do I live in? Which religious tract do I exercise out of? Who am I in terms of being a religious being and who are we in terms of being a religious community? That's the question. Who are we?